Trademarks to TikTok with today's special guest, Kelly Jones.
Today's episode is brought to you by Book Arbitrage Profits. If you want to start the ultimate side hustle, I can't recommend book flipping enough. Used books are continually going up in value. If you want to learn how to flip books and make six and even seven figures, please join our free training at servetomaster.com/BAPS.
Are you tired of dealing with your boss? Do you feel underpaid and underappreciated? If you want to make it online, fire your boss, and start living your retirement dreams now, then you've come to the right place. Welcome to Serve No Master Podcast, where you'll learn how to open new revenue streams and make money while you sleep. Presented live from a tropical island in the South Pacific by best-selling author Jonathan Green. Now, here's your host.
Now, this is very interesting to me because trademarks are a really tricky area for a lot of entrepreneurs. A lot of entrepreneurs make that early mistake and they go, how long should I do it? And then someone else claims and they can't figure out. So what's really interesting to me, I'd love to hear about your journey, how you take a subject that is very boring. Like it's very hard to do like talk trademark law, trademark research and make it interesting. And also there's a worry that a lot of people have like, oh, if I do something silly on TikTok, then people won't want to work with me because I'm too silly. How do you kind of handle that challenge?
Yeah, I just think that it is. I mean, all the legal kind of stuff is pretty boring. So I just try to make it, you know, as entertaining and as like least boring as possible. And I kind of just think like whatever people do see that and, you know, do want to work with me, then that's great. And for all the other people that don't want to work with me, you know, maybe they can go find a big law firm or something else if they're more comfortable with that. So I kind of just don't really worry about it.
So one of the big challenges is a lot of entrepreneurs I know, they go crazy with patents and trademarks early on before they have proof of concept. And I was part of a project where my business partner did that. I was like, what are you doing? We don't know if it's a good idea yet. We're doing all this complicated tax and legal structures and all of these things. I was like, these seem very silly to me. But there's also other aspect where people wait too long. When I filed my trademark, I was already in business for a couple of years. I had the domain name. I had my book had that name. My podcast had that name. So I already had a lot of security in the name. I was obviously first doing business and my book was selling well. And I kind of, as I grew, I go, oh, it's time to grab it. But I don't need a trademark for every different thing that I do as part of my business. And I don't really need to go after someone else. Like there is one motorcycle company that has t-shirts that say Serve No Master. I think they sell one shirt a year. I'm not going to go after them. I might ask for a free t-shirt at most, but it's overwhelming. What happened to me is as soon as I filed, I got maybe 50 to 70 emails from all these different law firms that, hey, you totally messed up. You're going to lose your patent. You're going to lose your life. You need to pay us $5,000 to fix it. You made a bunch of mistakes. And I turned out I did it right the first time. Very simple trademark. No one else used the name. Very unsurprising. I just happened to be very lucky, but it's very over. And now it's been my 5 years and between 5 and 6 years, you have to renew and show you're still doing it. Oh my gosh, I'm getting all these emails. You're going to lose your patent. You're going to go out of business. You're going to take your life. What are you doing? How does an entrepreneur navigate that when it's overwhelming? It's either the messages are so threatening, it's so scary that it makes you pull away.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't agree with lawyers that like send out pitches like that in the first place. It's not something I do. There are firms that do that, but those are kind of more like the firms that you want to avoid. So I would mostly tell people just ignore those emails. Think of them as like the same type of, you know, once you file the trademark, you're going to get a whole bunch of mail, like scams that are telling you to pay $1,000, $1,400, whatever to all these organizations. So, like keep your trademark, get it published, all these things that like none of them are true. You already paid your fees to the government. It's all scams. I kind of think of them all like the same way, pretty much, to just tell people to ignore them. And if you do work with a lawyer when you do it, then you don't get any of those emails from other firms and stuff. So then it's not really something you ever have to worry about either.
How does someone know they can do it themselves versus they definitely need help? Where's kind of that threshold?
So there are things that I think you can DIY when it comes to the legal, like you're filing an LLC, something like that, super pretty simple. But when it comes to a trademark, personally, I don't think that you should ever DIY it unless you are comfortable with paying more later on to fix it, because that tends to be what happens a lot. Yes, there are the people that get lucky, but even the people that DIY their application, a lot of times the description of services that they filed for is not the same description that a lawyer would put in. We would put more in to cover you. We would put more, you know, sometimes I see DIY people putting like a one line description, and we would put a lot more in to protect you, give you a broader protection, and maybe protect you more for the future. So really, when it comes to the trademark, that's not something that I recommend people DIYing, just because the consequences of not getting it are so, you know, you might have to either completely redo it or pay more to fix it in the middle if you get that refusal. Because at this point, it's about 9 to 10 months right now before an examiner is even getting assigned to your application. I know when you applied, if you applied, did it 5 years ago, it was probably much quicker. Now it's taking over a year to get a trademark. So just that first 9 months, you're waiting. So if you find out, you know, 10 months after you file that something's wrong and you have to either redo it or pay more to get it fixed, it doesn't really, you know, by that point, other people could have filed with something somewhat similar. Because since you filed, millions more people have filed just in 1 year alone. So it can cost you more money in the long run if you DIY it.
Let's talk about that, because that is the trickiest part when you have to select which categories your business is in. And they never make any sense. Even it's the same thing happens every time when I have to figure out what business category I'm in whenever I open a new bank account. And none of them like are post 1980. It's like they have a ton of them if you're like a lumberjack or if you're doing all these businesses that don't exist anymore. They never update them. And it is very confusing, because should I claim clothing? Because maybe I'll make clothes one day, but it's not my primary business. Should I claim these other categories? So what's that process like for someone starting out a business? How many categories should they go for right away? Where's the complexity? Let's talk about that part, because that's definitely the hardest part.
Yeah. So generally, I typically ask people, like, what are the goals for the next 1 to 3 years? Because there can be things that people think, okay, maybe I'll do in 5 years, but we don't really want to focus on that just yet, because you can apply either if you're already using something, you know, maybe a service that you already are monetizing, or something that you intend to use. But we want to think of things that you're actually intending to use within the next couple of years, because you're going to have to show proof of that. And if you don't have that proof, you're going to just be filing these extensions to keep pushing off the trademark. And that's going to increase your costs every 6 months that you have to file that extension. So really, it's like, what are you using now? And what are you using in the immediate future? And also the priority, you know, because each one is a separate filing fee. So sometimes it's a priority of like, what is the most important that you want to pay for? Typically, when people come to me, most people, we do have the outliers of people that are paying for like 5, 7, 9 classes. Most people generally file for 1 to 3 classes. And then maybe in the future, we'll file for more, you know, if they've expanded things. But that's pretty much the typical realm. And also, a lot of people, you know, do clothing maybe as like an addition. It's not their main business, but they also sell clothing or mugs or stickers. Focus on what you are actually, you know, the bulk of your business first, and then those additions of, you know, if you financially can do all the filing fees for those, just because it can add up really quick. You know, like clothing is one category, mugs is another, stickers is another, you know, journals, like all these things are different classes. So they're different $350 filing fees.
Oh, most people, when they think, oh, I need to get a trademark, it's defensive. They're thinking, oh, if someone tries to grab something from me. And how defensive do you need to be? For example, like I mentioned, there's someone else that makes a t-shirt with Serve No Master on it. I don't really care that much, because it's like the 57th result search engine. So it's not a big problem. It doesn't look like me. Like, nobody would go, oh, Jonathan also has a motorcycle brand, right? So I'm not so worried about competition, but do I need to claim other areas? Like, do I need to claim mugs if someone's putting out mugs? Because it's more I care about if there's a confusion more than anything else. So that's the question of like, how much territory do I need to grab defensively?
So that's overall, that's the point of trademarks, to avoid confusion, because you don't want consumers thinking that you are connected to that other brand. But you can only claim things that you're actually using or have an intent to use in the immediate 1 to couple years future. So if you don't have an intent to use them, or if you're not using them, then there's no point really in getting that. Like, you know, if you think that you want to expand to mugs, then you can go and file for that. But during the process, you have to show proof that you're actually selling them, whether that's a screenshot from your website or something like that showing it. So if you're not doing that, then there's no real point in grabbing all these other things, because the purpose isn't like this defense, like, you can't have this, you can't use this. It's really just so other people aren't confused with what you are already doing or what you're like really trying to do.
Yeah, because when I first started out online about 20 years ago, they were like, you have to buy the .com, the .net, and the .org, because someone else will buy the .net and try and steal your traffic or steal your audience. And that's unfortunately gone away. But I think that's how a lot of people think. It's like, oh, I don't want someone to infringe or that kind of thing. They're worried about that attack, which I don't know how common that is. Like, I've never had a problem with that. Like, I don't think once your size where people want to steal your brand name, I think it's a different place to be anyways, right? Where you have to have a big enough business to be worth doing that. But the part about like the mark itself, because you can either just do the text or you can do like a drawing. And one thing I know is that I've gone through like 7 logos over the last few years. Like, I definitely was like, oh, I don't want to grab this logo because I'm going to change my mind. But a lot of people, like when I first was talking to attorneys, they did all these searches for these different things that look like my logo. I was like, what are you doing? I don't care about that. I just care about the 3 words. I want to be able to do whatever I want with it. I'm not inventing the Nike swoosh, right? Like, I'm not going that far. I'm not the FedEx secret arrow. Like, I'm just my name. But a lot of people, if you do that and you claim that specific mark and then you change it, you go to a different logo design, what's that process like? Do you have to resubmit stuff?
Yeah, you do. So typically when people come to me, I ask them, you know, I ask them all about their logo, like if there's a design element to it, how strongly they feel about it, what the overall, you know, like their goals are with it. Because some people you can file for both the words and the logo if you want to, also if you have the money to do so. But I always tell people that not every single time, but for the most part, the best thing to file for is the words themselves, because then you can get ownership over those words and you can use it in any font, any color, any size, whatever you want with it. Whereas if you do file in only the logo with it, which I do see a lot of businesses doing, then you're only getting protection in that exact format. And then, you know, some people you can apply either in black and white, which then at least gives you the option to change colors. But if you apply in color too, then you're limiting yourself even more into that exact, like those shades even. So I always tell people, you know, like, unless you're like very set on that logo, but most times businesses do at least tweak logos over time. And then you're going to have to file a whole new application for a whole new trademark. So at least get the words and then you can do whatever you want with it.
Yeah. One of my worries was you get a logo, you think it's unique, right? Maybe you spend $100, $200, then you file for it and it turns out someone else has something similar. Like that's what I discovered, because mine, I don't know why they were searching for like circles and half moons, and there's 1,000 logos with a half moon in it, right? Like, of course there's a half circle shape. That's not a unique shape. And I was like, I definitely don't want to go down this road. I feel like you're more likely to get rejected as well, because it's so easy to have something similar. Someone else uses that font. It turns out it's a commercial font, which I run into a lot. People don't realize you have to pay for fonts, and that can be another challenge. So it seems like it's safer, because when I filed, yeah, it was about 5 months. Very easy process. I know now, thanks to Amazon, there's millions of people doing it. Amazon says everyone has to have an LLC, so they're all filing these trademarks, causing this big thing. Now waiting twice as long, that would be really scary. Like, you definitely don't want that to happen. The other question is, like, what should people expect the process to cost? Because there's also the thing where some lawyers like, you got to file for your trademark internationally. I'm like, I already know in China, they're going to steal it. Like, it's just how it is, right? You can buy Microsoft everywhere. They're stealing from Microsoft. They're going to be able to steal from me. I don't know why people file trademarks everywhere. Why do people go down that path? And really, what are the essentials besides America? Do we really need to claim anywhere else?
So it really depends on where you're selling. If you are selling, you know, if you're doing a lot of business in Canada or the UK or wherever, then you might want to consider filing there. Sometimes it's also easier to expand into other countries if you're doing a few at a time, or if you file first in the US and then do it within a couple of months and use, you know, you can use your US registration as a basis to apply in other places. Most of my clients are small business owners, so typically we file in the US and we don't really file elsewhere in the world unless they do vastly expand their business somewhere else. And maybe, you know, maybe that's Canada first. But unless you're doing a very large global business, or really just any global business at all, that's really when you would think of expanding in other countries, is depending on how much business you're doing there, really.
And how much should someone budget for the process? I don't know what the prices are anymore. I'm going through that new process of showing proof of all my different categories again. But how much should someone plan for this process if they're going to just get maybe 1 to 2 categories, just US, and they're going to work with a lawyer?
Because I typically tell people, yeah, it is. I typically tell people about 2,000 to 4,000 is pretty average. This is because including the filing fees, which are $250 to $350 per class of goods or services, which I believe they are trying to increase them yet again next year. And this, it might sound, especially for people earlier on in their business, like that's a lot. Most of the fee or half of the fee essentially is going to that search that we're doing before we actually file, because now, you know, trademark real estate is dwindling. It's very much more common to receive a refusal for your trademark being too similar to someone else's. And that's something that we'll kind of assess prior to even wasting the time filing. So that's typically 2 to 4, depending on the attorney you use.
Let's talk about that search process. Because when I was working with a law firm, my family's all lawyers. So I started working with a trademark attorney and they sent me, I could tell their research was bad. Like that's the best way to say it. They were obviously overcharging my family. I could tell. I was like, this is all the wrong stuff. I went to the website myself and just did a search for my phrase. And there's nobody that has it. Nobody has ServNo. There was one company like 20 years ago that had a mark in one category I don't use. And they were like only using the word serve. So is there something beyond that or for simple words only? I know for images, it's a whole different ballgame. For just words, is it just searching the patent and trademark website or is there more to it now?
So there's way more to it because you can do a basic free search on the trademark website, but you'll likely not get a full picture because it's not just identical things that are an issue. It's also anything that sounds similar, looks similar, has a similar meaning. So we use different websites. We pay for them that use full algorithms to look for things because, you know, yours is ServNo Master, but people spell things all different ways. Like it could be master, masters, mastery, even master. It could be like, I don't know, captain, like, there's all these different things that, and it doesn't necessarily matter if like you and I think things are similar because sometimes an examiner is like, no, it's too similar. Like I've had examiners say like, come back with these wild things that like, I do not think that there's any confusion or they're similar at all. Even the words I don't think are that similar, but they do think they're similar, especially now it's just even increasing. So that's really what that search does is look for all these algorithms and uses the algorithms to come up with anything that is even remotely similar. So we have a full picture of like what we're getting into. So we can kind of know like, okay, maybe these things will get cited, but if they do, we have an argument to try to differentiate our brand from their brands.
So let's talk about that. Can you give me some examples of like words, like the most dissimilar words that they still said were similar, ones that kind of surprised you? Like the words were, is it more about these words are synonyms or is it more that the meaning is the same? Can you give me kind of some examples that we understand?
Yeah, so it can be both. So for example, I have one client that has two words in her brand and one of the words is a unique word. And she just got an office action cited for 6 other things that all have that word in them, but then multiple other different words. So like, and some of them even have very unique words in themselves, either like made up words or just unique words in themselves, not like coffee or, you know, something that's descriptive of the goods or services. And they still issued all these refusals for all of these other ones that, you know, they share one common term out of like 2 to 3 words, sometimes even 4. And they've issued all these refusals for them, not saying the name only because it's a pending trademark and I can't say it. But that is kind of the situation that we're running into a lot where there's a lot of other words in these trademarks that are not similar. You know, it's not just like someone has the exact name that we're getting the thing for. I had one that was the blonde hostess, and we got like refusals for all of these other things with blonde in it. We blonde itself, but then we got like blonde, like I forget what they are at the time, but like a word that was not hostess, completely other words, not the same goods and services either. And we just got a refusal for a bunch of them. I think they're being a lot pickier now with what is similar or not, even in, because, you know, they look at the word themselves, how similar it is to someone else, but they also look at the goods and services, how similar. And I had one client who she was a fitness coach, and there was a similar mark, not identical, but similar for a social media coach. And the examiner said that they were too similar, even though no one is accidentally buying a Zumba class when they meant to like hire a coach for social media. Like, that's not happening, but they said it was too similar. So yeah, it can be kind of difficult.
Once you have your mark, like once you have your trademark, how much do you have to actively defend it, right? Like I know that sometimes things happen, like is there a possibility really of you losing it? And what is that situation like?
Yeah, so technically once you get the trademark registration, you do have a duty to police your mark, you know, from if you see infringers, you're supposed to tried to get them to stop using it and not just, you know, like let them, like, let's say it's other big business or not big, but, you know, businesses that are using it. You're not supposed to just let them use it if it's in the something that is causing confusion. But, you know, some people do, there are instances where people do have to send a cease and desist or something like that. Generally, if you are a much smaller business, it's not something that you're out there doing that often. But sometimes people do pop up, especially, you know, like on social media with another social media account, maybe, or something like that, that we do have to either ask them to take it down or have someone take it down. Sometimes there are instances where, like, they will try to file like some type of proceeding because of your trademark. But I would say those are like not super common scenarios where someone would do something like that.
So an example for me is that I have the trademark for Serve No Master. It's my flagship book. No one else can grab that title. But my other book, which was really popular, Fire Your Boss, 50 other authors came out and put out a book the same name to kind of go after me. Is it worth, if I go and get the trademark, can I then kick all those books out of the game?
So
is that worth the effort? And what's that kind of process like?
Yeah, so technically you can't trademark a book title for one book. You have to have a series. Otherwise, it's not like an actual trademark. So you can't just trademark a book title or stop someone else from using the title of a book name unless it's a series. That's just like how it is under the actual trademark law. So unless you're having a series for that and then filing the trademark, then you could prevent other people, but not really before then under the trademark law.
Okay. This is all very interesting. What I'd love to talk about now is your transition to kind of carving out your real estate on social media. What was your strategy for growing on TikTok and what are the highs and lows? Just tell me your journey.
Yeah. So I kind of started towards the beginning of my business. I started on TikTok as well. And I kind of just decided that I was going to take it seriously, regardless of how many followers I had. And I just kind of decided like, okay, I'm just going to keep posting regardless of how many views I get. And over time, I got, you know, unattached really to the outcome of how many views I was getting, how many likes, saves, shares, all these things. And then I did have a viral video about LLCs within a couple months of, you know, starting to continuously post on TikTok. And that kind of like kickstarted my TikTok growth. And then it kind of also just inspired me to even keep going. So my strategy is just to post most days on TikTok and, you know, as educational without trying to be as boring as possible. And I go through a lot of periods where there's like lulls, you know, low views, 200s, 300 views, with not a lot of, you know, it doesn't seemingly seem like it's worth it at times, but I just try to push through that. And then usually within a couple months, like something happens, or within a couple weeks, I'll see that I have a form, you know, when people schedule consultations where they found me, and I'll see like, oh, it's someone from TikTok. And then I'll see, okay, even though I'm only getting 200 views, I'm still attracting some business owners that are looking for help. So that's kind of what just keeps me going even through the low engagement periods.
It seems like a lot of people post 2 to 5 videos and then just quit. They give up too soon. So what would you say to people that are kind of worrying about that? And they're like, oh, I want my first video to go viral.
Well, first, like, I feel like the more videos you post, the more likely you might go viral just because of the quantity. So one, just keep going, keep posting consistently. For some people, they might have a viral video on their first video. Some people it's 10, some people it's 100, some people maybe it's 1,000. But even if your first viral video isn't until your 1,000th video, like, that doesn't mean that your first 999 are bad and won't do anything for your business. You know, you can still, like I said, even on some of my periods where I'm getting 200 views for a month or two at a time, like, I'm still bringing in clients from those. So not everything has to go viral. And sometimes people go viral. A lot of people that do end up going viral, it's for something that's unrelated to their business. And then that doesn't really help them anyway, because the people they're bringing in aren't like their ideal audience. So, you know, virality isn't really everything. Sometimes even just, you know, staying consistent with something is really what is going to benefit you more in the long run.
So what would you advise people that are trying to figure out how many times a day should they post? How long should they stay before they give up? What are kind of the guidance?
Yeah. So I typically tell people to post whatever you can be consistent with. So for some people that might be like 3 times a day. For some people, that's once a day. For some people, it might be like 3 or 4 videos a week. I think whichever frequency that is fine as long as you can be consistent with it, because over time, it's not going to matter as much. Sure, if you're posting many more times a day, every day, it might help kickstart in the beginning because it's going to speed up the time that it takes you to get better with videos. And also, it's going to be easier to film them because you're going to be getting more and more used to it quicker. But overall, in the long scheme of things, I don't think it really matters about frequency as much as that you're staying consistent with it and you're not like diving off and, you know, stopping for 3 months at a time. So really whatever you feel comfortable doing, and also to test out different types of videos, different lengths, different. I do a lot of like talking videos, talking to the camera for like 30 to 60 seconds. That I found is what works best for me, but maybe it's not for you. Maybe it's a short video with text over it, you know, like a lot of what people are doing on Instagram right now. So test out a lot of different types of videos and see what works for you. See what you like best too. And just stick with it really is the most important thing.
You shared a lot of really good stuff with us today. For people who want to learn more about you, maybe learn more about Trademark stuff, or just see the amazing stuff you're doing on TikTok, where's the best place for people to find you?
Yeah, TikTok, it's Lawyer Kelly with an I. And on Instagram, it's the same Lawyer Kelly with an I, but an underscore after as well.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for being here. I'll make sure to put those in the show notes and below the video on YouTube. And I know everyone's going to really love this. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Serve No Master podcast. Make sure to subscribe so that together we can achieve true freedom.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Serve No Master podcast. Make sure you subscribe so you never miss another episode. We'll be back next week with more tips and tactics on how to escape the rat race. Please take a moment to leave a review at servenomaster.com/iTunes. It helps the show grow, and more listeners means more content for you. Thanks again, and we'll see you next week.